Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He's the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon, and his latest book just out is Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Ian, it's always a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And Locke, you, for this book that you've written, you've interviewed every director of Central Intelligence between 1966 and 2004. You've also interviewed the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. From what I'm seeing, just watching interviews with former heads of CIA and NSA, et cetera, everybody is absolutely alarmed at the destruction of American intelligence. First, it was attacked by Donald Trump, but now it's being undermined, from what we can tell, by Devin Nunes, not just in releasing information to the public that the FBI and the DOJ adamantly did not want released to the public about the FISA courts, etc. But he's gone as far as to call his minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, and other Democrats on that committee a bunch of liars. And Trump has called them a bunch of liars and leakers. So I don't think you could have a worse situation. And wasn't the Intelligence Committees, both the House and Senate committees, when you worked on setting them up in the first place, weren't they sort of organized around a principle of bipartisanship?
Well, Ian, you're exactly right about that. And I am recalling in my mind 1976, when we created the Senate Intelligence Committee, and then a year later, the House Intelligence Committee. This is all based on the work of the Church Committee, which investigated the CIA and the other intelligence agencies for 16 months, and found that, by and large, they're vital to the nation, and they do good work, and we owe our safety to them. But unfortunately, some members of those agencies have become overzealous and done things that were in violation of the law. So the idea was to set up these permanent committees who could keep an eye on these now 17 agencies day in and day out. And we also thought, and that was the view at the time, that the committees would operate in a bipartisan manner. After all, intelligence was a very sensitive matter, fragile operations, perishable operations, and this couldn't be politics as usual. And if you look at the early committees, the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees in their first couple of decades, they honored that notion of bipartisanship and keeping intelligence out of politics. But then things went off the trail, and I think the first sign of that was when the Reagan administration wanted to pursue covert action in Nicaragua. By covert action, I mean the CIA trying to disrupt another government, whereas the Democrats under Jimmy Carter felt that the leader of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, was perhaps not the ideal friend to have in that country, but was a fairly trustworthy and certainly someone we could work with, and no one we wanted to invade. So there was a real difference of view there, and that was the first divide, I think, between the Republicans and Democrats on intelligence. And then, just if I may say briefly, along came Newt Gingrich, a representative from the state of Georgia, and his theory was, if you trash the Democrats enough, maybe the public will vote the Republicans in a majority, and the theory seemed to work out pretty well. But unfortunately, it poisoned the waters in Washington, and now you've got this hostility between the two parties, as magnified as never before by, as you point out, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
But it's not just the politicians that are in this poisonous, partisan, tribal kind of condition. It's the Republican voters, according to the latest poll. 73% of Republican voters believe what Donald Trump is saying, and that this investigation's going on to him are biased, and that the FBI and the DOJ are, in effect, a bunch of sort of closet liberals and Hillary lovers. I mean, it's an insane idea, but 73%, That's been been the drumbeat of Fox News and other in the right-wing media have been creating this kind of narrative for some time, but apparently it has stuck. And The other statistic that just came out in a poll yesterday, that in 2015, 85% of Republicans had admired the FBI, and today it's down to 38%.
Yes. Well, Ian, I think what we see at work here is the White House propaganda machine getting the word out to the right-wing media, and the American people, understandably, hear all this news, and they wonder if it might not be correct. But I think in the fullness of time, over the next few months, particularly as the special counsel reports on his investigation, we're going to have a better, more balanced set of facts. And then the American people, as they always do, will make a more sound judgment once all the facts are in. So this is a preliminary and actually misguided view of the facts, I believe, based on what I know. But I think this is good to have this debate, and I can't wait for Mueller to have his report out. Unfortunately, though, if you look at the history of these two intelligence committees, which we started off talking about, never before, out of 15 leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee and 14 of the House, or I should say 12 of the House, have we had a leader so ideologically prone. He's got a perfect right-wing rating in the voting tabulations that various interest groups keep, and that's never been the case before. In fact, the average rating for leaders of those two committees has been right about 48, which is where you'd want it to be, I think, sort of an indication of moderateness between 100 and a zero. So we've gone from having moderate leaders to having this right-wing ideologue, and worse than that, he is nothing but a cheerleader for the White House. And he goes down, talks to the president periodically, and finds out what he's supposed to do next, and goes up on the Hill and carries out that agenda. So I must say, I say this with a heavy heart, because I don't like to disparage any representative of the American people, but surely the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee must realize that their leader right now is ruining the House Intelligence Committee, and they have to find a replacement for him.
And you're, of course, referring to Devin Nunes.
Yes, Devin Nunes.
And again, I'm speaking with Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He is the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon. And his latest book just out is Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. So my understanding, though, Locke, is that not just the poisoning of, as you mentioned, Devin Nunes as an ideologue, and the whole purpose of the, not the purpose, but the tradition of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees was to have bipartisan leadership and to sort of, you know, leave your partisanship at the door when you go into,
yes,
into the kind of, you know, the secret room where they talk about this stuff. So beyond the fact that he's made the House Intelligence Committee dysfunctional, my understanding is that foreign intelligence agencies and services that work closely with the United States are now having second thoughts, if not already closing the door on sharing information. We learned recently that Dutch intelligence was responsible for finding out that the Russian GRU was hacking the DNC. And that was real-time information, which obviously was very useful to,
yes,
U.S. intelligence. There are many examples, and, you know, the Baltic intelligence services apparently learning a lot about what Russia is up to. But why would these intelligence services want to share it now with the United States if there's a guy, you know, that's going to have oversight that can rummage through and their secrets and leak them according to his political dogma?
Yes, I think you make a good point. And as you recall, the FBI said to Nunes, look, don't declassify and release this document because it would lead to grave concerns for the country's national security. And yet he had not only had the Republicans support declassification on his committee, but then took it to the president, which is part of the rule, and the president was very happy to declassify it. So when you willy-nilly throw classified information into the air like that, it causes concern with our allies overseas. I think that can be overstated, though, because after all, these liaisons that we have with the Dutch and the British and many other people are so important to both of us, we're not about to abandon them. But still, it does cast a chilling effect, I think, on the relationship and may give pause to some of our allies before they share information fully with us. So, you know, there are rules in place to make sure declassified information is is done in a very careful, slow, methodical way. And in Nunes' case, he didn't even have hearings on it. He could have brought up the FBI and he could have said, well, tell us what your grave concerns are. We want to hear more about this. But he didn't even bother. He just went ahead.
Well, but there's obviously complicity with the White House because General Kelly just said a couple of days ago that when asked about the fate of the Democratic rebuttal memo, which is now at the White House going through the same process, in the case of the Nunes memo, the White House didn't redact anything. And in fact, they absolutely overruled the pleadings from the FBI and the DOJ, who, for example, didn't want the names of all of the people that had authorized these FISA warrants. And of course, if you go through the list, they're all people that either Trump has forced out or has fired, and with the last one being Rosenstein, who seems to be in the crosshairs at the moment. But the double standard is so flagrant because now General Kelly's saying, well, you know, it's going to take us time. We're going to have to redact a lot of this Democratic memo, and we'll only release it if the FBI head Chris Wray and Rod Rosenstein approve it. Well, they didn't approve the last one, and the Nunes one. They went ahead and put it out and defied them. But now they're saying, oh, we're going to play by the rules this time. And so I'm not sure that the Democratic memo is ever going to see the light of day. And if it does, it'll be so shredded with redactions, it'll probably be completely incoherent.
It'll look like Swiss cheese. No, I think you're right. There's a double standard work here. And I think even Trump's base will wonder about the fairness of all this. After all, they're intelligent people, and they voted for him because they were concerned about their jobs and the sagging U.S. economy, at least in their part of the United States. So they had their reasons for voting for him, but I think that they've been disappointed by such things as this double standard approach and his really cavalier approach to intelligence. You probably remember, Ian, when President went out to the CIA at Langley, Virginia, to speak to them early in his administration. He was outright insulting to them. He left there with not a friend, I don't think, because he had said so many disparaging things about intelligence being useless and biased and so on, which is really not the case, of course, but that's the way he viewed it. And now he's attacking the FBI. So these are extremely important, patriotic, hardworking, and usually quite reliable organizations. Obviously, they've gone off track, and my book talks about some of the times where they've broken the law because they became overzealous about some matters. But those were exceptional cases. For the most part, these reliable agencies was honest, patriotic, hardworking people, and we need them. And we need to have their morale high so they'll do good work. And the president and Nunes are just destroying that morale.
Well, in terms of the inside the Fox News bubble and the way that it's being framed by Trump is that this is essentially, and this is what the build-up to the Nunes memo was, they were basically beating the drum on the idea that there was a secret society inside the FBI based upon, you know, email exchanges or text message exchanges between a couple of FBI agents. That so in effect they were saying, you know, there's a secret society within the deep state. And this idea has taken on amongst Trump's supporters that this deep state is out to do in this president and is behind this bogus Russian inquiry.
Right.
That's their mindset. But the interesting thing that I'm hearing is I've talked to a bunch of retired intelligence officers, members, if you will, of the deep state, and they're concerned about something quite different. They're concerned about a White House coup against American democracy. So it's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's depressing, actually.
Well,
Trump's people think that the deep state's out to get him. And people in the deep state are worried that Trump is out to undermine American democracy.
Well, I really do think we all need to keep our paranoia in check because one can get carried away here. Remember when Orson Welles gave the radio broadcast about how the Martians had landed in New Jersey and some people believed it and they took off to the hills? So we don't want to get too carried away here, but I think it is true, I believe, based on 40 years of studying the subject, there's no such thing as a secret society or a cabal within these agencies. These are a cross-section of American people. It used to be the CIA was known to be dominated by the Ivy League, but that was in the 40s and 50s. These agencies, CIA, FBI, and the other, I guess, 15 or 16 of them, are really a reflection of American society. and they're not that much different from the rest of us. So I think it's foolish to talk about the deep state. Now, remember Eisenhower's farewell address where he warned about a military-industrial complex? I think that's alive and well, and if you want to call that a deep state, I suppose you could, but it's not that secret. It's true that munitions manufacturers and people on the Armed Services Committees and some others, some generals, for example, or admirals in the Pentagon, have a vested interest in working on military projects, which goes beyond the tenure of any president who's there for 4 or 8 years. So, as Eisenhower told us, there is, in that sense, a kind of sub-government that's underway, but it's not at all the sinister kind of demon that some people have envisioned.
Well, the military-industrial complex just got a windfall in this budget agreement coming out of the Senate. extra $80 billion on top of the...
Yes. I think Well, Ian, I'd love for you to explain to me why we have 10 going on 12 aircraft carriers, and the few other countries in the world that even have an aircraft carrier have one.
Right. And the Russian one is antique, and the Chinese one was bought from the Ukrainians.
I know.
And it's not particularly effective.
I know.
So, no, it's an extraordinary thing. But, Locke Johnson, just to go back to the history, because, you know, all the work that you did, and I must say, you know, I knew William Colby quite well, and he really did testify relentlessly before the Church and Park Committees, just opening up all of the abuses, and an extraordinary time it was where all of the dirty laundry was aired, and the whole point was to make these corrective measures, which led to these oversight committees in the Senate and House.
Yes.
And now we're in a situation where they're being undone by, you know, poisoned by partisanship. So what was the sense back then? Because it's sort of, you know, I mean, still to this day, some of the extraordinary. I mean, I remember talking to Bill Colby about James Jesus Angleton.
Yes.
How this one guy almost wrecked the CIA. So it's possible to have, we talked about Nunez being an ideologue and the wrong person to be anywhere near an intelligence committee. But, I mean, I don't know about Pompeo. I don't know what these characters are like now. But you go back to people like Angleton, you think, my God, you know, it's lucky.
Yes.
We survived.
Yes.
You know.
Well, no, I think you make some wonderful points, but we do have to be careful about describing an organization based on some rather bizarre individuals. And I think Angleton, I've got a whole chapter in my book on Angleton, was kind of an outlier and a strange individual in a lot of ways. But I think he's not the typical CIA officer by any means. Again, let me repeat, a typical CIA officer is someone I think the American people would respect, well-educated, well-meaning, patriotic, hard-working. And the same would be true with people in the other intelligence agencies, which is not to say, as you pointed out, that occasionally they haven't strayed off the reservation and done things that they shouldn't have. And that's why we created those two intelligence committees, one in the Senate and one in the House. And we were very respectful of Bill Colby because he was willing to understand that we needed to have intelligence within the framework of the Constitution, not lying outside the Constitution. So, in fact, he used to say CIA, Constitutional Intelligence in America. And that's what our common goal was. Of course, he took a lot of flack from President Ford and Henry Kissinger for being too open. But Colby's view was, and he was right about this, if he wasn't forthcoming and cooperative with Congress, we would have shut down the CIA. So he came forward within limits. He wasn't completely candid about everything. He didn't want hearings on covert action, for example, and we honored that. But he came forward and helped us understand Operation Chaos, the spying on American citizens, and other programs that were clearly way beyond the legal boundaries. And he helped us fix that problem.
Well, but as you probably know, Locke Johnson, many Americans on the political left, and on the right, too, are very suspicious. On the right, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories, as we've talked about, the deep state. But on the left, there's a tremendous sense of the CIA being behind all of America's problems and have done terrible things in our name, if you will, around the world. And they have their finger in all kinds of coups. And we know that during the Cold War, the reason it was a Cold War was that neither side could afford to have a hot war. That would have ended the planet. So what they did was they kind of caused all this misery in the Third World via surrogate wars. And you could even argue that Korea and Vietnam were surrogate wars on a massive scale, but there were all kinds of small wars.
Right.
So there's a legacy there of tremendous distrust, and I get mail, even by interviewing former CIA officers who I talk to, simply because I know they know a lot what I don't know. You know, they have the secret. So, you know, you always, as a journalist, you're always trying to find out what the hell's going on.
Right.
I get called a CIA agent or a
stooge.
Well, how do you address those people, in other words?
Well, I think you make some great points. And I remember a New Yorker cartoon some years ago where natives on a Pacific island were running away from a volcano as the volcano's lava was pouring out, and one native yelled to the other, "The CIA did it, the CIA did it." So the CIA is suspected of doing a lot of bad things around the world, and sometimes that suspicion is right. I mean, personally, I'm utterly appalled by the torture program they had. I mean, anyone who studied the literature on torture practices in the past realize it doesn't work, and it's such a blemish on the reputation of the United States. Or rendition, and kidnapping people off the streets of Stockholm or other places who are suspected terrorists and flying them to Egypt so their intelligence service can do more brutal things against them than the CIA is allowed to do. I mean, all that waterboarding 137 times in one case, all that is just nauseating, because the great strength of the United States is our reputation for goodwill and fair play around the world, which is by and large accurate. But when we engage as a government in torture and rendition and metadata collection and getting wiretaps without warrants, that really plays into the hands of our enemies, because it makes us look just like Russia, which we're not most of the time. But occasionally we've slipped because some people have been overzealous. And that's why we need these committees to be strong, neutral, bipartisan, constantly looking into these agencies to make sure they stay within the boundaries of the law.
Well, just in closing, Locke Johnson, what I find puzzling, though, in terms of what we're talking about, that is that the CIA basically gets blamed for essentially what the executive branch does, and we're talking basically about the president, in the sense that from what my studies, and I think to some extent they're reinforced in your book, Spy Watching, presidents, when they come in, find, even like Jimmy Carter, they find that the CIA is the most interesting toy of the executive branch. You know,
you're right.
And I'm sure Donald Trump feels that way too. And it's the presidents who task the CIA to do a lot of stuff that ends up getting them in trouble. But why do we let the presidents off the hook and blame the CIA?
Well, I think because over the years the CIA has gotten its reputation for overthrowing governments and even engaging in assassination plots and all the rest, and the literature and the reporting on it tends to say the CIA did this and the CIA did that. But I think you're right. In probably 90% of the cases, the CIA was following instructions from the White House. And since 1975 with the Church Committee, we now have pretty good reporting on some of these activities. For instance, the CIA cannot conduct a covert action, be it propaganda, economic or political disruption, or even paramilitary activities, without first getting a formal authority from the president, which didn't always happen in the past, and then, most important of all, telling the Senate and House Intelligence Committees about it in advance, so they'll have a chance to say, wait a minute, that's a stupid idea, don't do that. So I think we've gotten better in that domain, and the number of madcap operations overseas has, I think, declined. But here at home, and in Guantanamo, and a few black sites of prisons abroad, the CIA got involved in yet more mischief with torture and rendition. So, you know, Thomas Jefferson used to talk about how eternal vigilance was the price of liberty, and that's so true today. And who's doing the vigilance for us? It's supposed to be the House and Senate Intelligence Committee. But in the House, you've got Nunes, who is not objective and not impartial and not representing the views of the Congress, but rather in the pocket of the White House. That's not acceptable.
Well, Locke Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and I thank you in particular for your new book, Spy Watching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States.
What a privilege to be with you, and thank you very much for your kind words about the book, and I wish you all the best.
And again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He is the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as Staff Director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as Assistant to the Chairman of the Aspen-Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon. His latest book just out is Spy Watching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.